right out.
Nilo shuffled into the office, looking surly. His demeanor clearly showed that he had simply dragged himself out of bed, pulled on his uniform, and come straight out to face his accusers. Gwen took the lead.
Okay, Nilo, what have you done?
Nilo laughed.
You don't understand? No, of course you don't. You sorceresses, you all think you're smarter than everyone, but I've shown you all!
He looked at Gwen and Martin with a mixture of amusement and disgust. He shook his head and said,
Isn't it obvious? Can't you see what I've done? Do you really need me to explain it to you?
Uh-oh, Martin thought. I don't like this. Have we underestimated him? Has he been playing Ida all along?
Nilo said,
I have killed Britt the Younger.
That answers that question, Martin thought.
Ida said,
Dear, you haven't killed Britt.
Yes, I have,
Nilo said.
I killed her!
Ida said,
Okay, you're right, you killed her.
Nilo turned back to Gwen, feeling vindicated. Ida smiled at Gwen and winked.
Why?
Gwen asked.
Why did you do it, Nilo?
Nilo shook his head. He looked amazed at Gwen's stupidity. He turned to Ida, who play-acted his amazement back to him. He turned back to Gwen and replied,
Because I wanted her dead, obviously.
Ida looked as if she might laugh, but she peered up at Nilo with adoration in her eyes, like a pet owner watching her clumsy puppy trip and fall.
Well, I knew that, Gwen said.
Sure you did,
Nilo said.
That's why you had to ask, because you knew.
Clearly, if you were trying to kill her, you wanted her dead. That much is obvious.
Obvious now that I've told you. I suppose you also realize that killing Britt the Younger would also kill Britt the Elder. And with both of them gone, Ida is in charge.
Well, of course,
Gwen sputtered.
But that can't work.
It has worked. And anyway, if you already knew everything, why didn't you stop me?
Well,
Gwen said,
we didn't know it was you doing it.
Nilo laughed contemptuously.
You're making yourself look dumb. If you didn't know I was the one doing it, then you can't have known what my plan was because you didn't know it was my plan. Think!
He pointed at his head to drive his point home. Martin felt for Gwen. She was arguing with a dumb person, which never works. For a smart person to argue with a dumb person, they have to dumb down their logic on the fly, while the dumb person thinks in dumb logic naturally, giving them an advantage. Martin decided to end Gwen's suffering. Martin stepped forward and asked,
Where'd you send them?
Nilo asked,
What does it matter? You're all so much smarter than I am, and you say my plan can't have worked, so it can't matter where I sent them, can it?
Martin tightened his grip on his staff, gritted his teeth, and grunted,
Where?
Nilo laughed, clearly unconcerned.
Okay, big man, don't get upset. I'll tell you. I had two ideas. I thought I might just throw them high up in the sky over the city and then watch them fall to their deaths.
Gwen said,
That wouldn't have worked.
Could have,
Nilo replied.
They can fly.
Gwen persisted. Nilo shrugged.
So you say.
You've seen Philip fly with your own eyes,
Gwen yelled.
Eh,
Nilo said.
I don't know. Maybe he needs to run real fast to take off. Maybe he was being held up by very thin ropes. Point is, it was worth a shot.
No, it wasn't,
Nilo smiled.
Well, luckily, that's not what I did.
Gwen shouted,
Obviously!
Martin put a calming hand on her shoulder and repeated his last question.
Where did you send them, Nilo?
Nilo said,
The middle of the ocean.
The middle of the ocean,
Martin repeated.
Yes. I picked a spot far away from any land and placed the exit portal just above the surface of the sea. As soon as your friends disappeared into the wall, they reappeared out among the waves and immediately sank into the sea and drowned.
Ampix muttered, A terrible way to go. Martin, Gwen, and Ida all knew that while wizards, sorcerers, and all other magic users were impervious to physical damage, disease, and aging, they could still die of thirst, starve, suffocate, or drown. Martin looked at Ida. She didn't look angry or horrified. She had a slightly disgusted look on her face, like a cat owner who has found her beloved kitten playing with a freshly killed mouse. Quietly, Gwen said,
"That wouldn't work."
Nilo asked,
"What?"
Gwen said,
"That would never work. You know that can't work. You blew up Brit's sphere when they were hundreds of feet beneath the surface and it didn't kill them. Why should dropping Brit in from the surface be any different?"
Nilo puffed up his chest, raised his nose in the air, and revealed his master stroke.
"Because those arrows that were stuck to her were tied to a very heavy rock."
"But she has magic!"
Gwen was yelling again.
"Both she and Philip can do magic!"
Martin leaned toward Gwen, and in a quiet voice said,
"Philip couldn't. He dropped his staff before he went through, remember? Without that, the shell wouldn't recognize him."
Martin didn't add that Philip very well could have drowned. He didn't have to. Gwen said,
"Well, that's always been the shell's main design flaw. Brit doesn't use the shell anyway. She uses the Atlantis interface."
"Yeah,"
Martin said.
"You used that flicking through options with your hand, right? Her arm was gummed up by the arrows."
Gwen said,
"You can use either hand, Martin."
Martin said,
"Philip was holding on to the other hand."
It was too terrible to think about, but also too terrible to put out of their minds. Whether out of love or panic or just plain stubbornness, it was possible that in trying to save Brit's life, Philip had killed them both. Martin noted that for the first time, Ida looked genuinely concerned.
"Well, there you have it," he said. "Through a combination of dumb luck and just dumb."
Martin trailed off, looking at Nilo, trying to find the perfect word. Finally, he continued.
Dumbness? Your boy toy may have killed two people, and you helped. What are you going to do about it?"
Ida thought for a moment, then said,
"That is the question, isn't it? I guess I do have to decide how we proceed from here, since I am the only surviving member of the Council of Three."
Gwen said,
"Ida, you don't honestly think that means anything, do you? The Council only existed because Brit the Elder wanted it to, and even if it did mean anything at all..."
"True,"
Ida said,
"but Brit the Elder is gone, and so is Brit the Younger, and I was popular enough to get unanimously voted president. I think there's a good chance the sorceresses will follow me now that there's nobody else to follow."
Gwen asked,
"But what's the point? We already have all the food, money, and security we could ever want. Why do you have to be in charge?"
Ida laughed.
"So that everybody'll do what I say, hang on my every word, and look up to me, like they do to Brit the Elder. Being president has given me a taste. Turns out I like it. I didn't plan any of this, but I think we might be able to make the best of it."
Gwen said,
"There's no way the sorceresses are going to let you stay president once they know what you two have done."
Ida said,
"I suppose that's true."
Nilo stretched himself to his full height. He glared down at Martin and said,
"I'll just have to stop you from telling anyone."
Martin glared back and said,
"Try and stop us."
Nilo cracked his knuckles, then quickly swiped his finger through the air and poked it forward, making a selection. The floor beneath Martin, Gwen, and Ampix shattered with the sound of several champagne corks popping. The three of them fell several inches into the portal that Nilo had set up just beneath the floor in case of a situation like this. 33. When Gwen, Martin, and Ampix fell through the portal, emerging in a shower of shattered floor fragments thousands of feet in the air over the city of Atlantis, they were all surprised and angry. Ampix was surprised and angry at Nilo for trying to kill him. Gwen and Martin were surprised and angry at themselves for allowing someone to get the drop on them again. Of course, the last time they had been amongst 20 other wizards, and they had all been stripped of their powers. This time was not nearly as bad. Gwen was tied into the Atlantis interface and the Camelot shell. She was already flying toward Ampix with great speed. Unfortunately, Martin's staff had gotten hung up on the side of the portal as he fell through, and in his shock, he had let it slip from his fingers. Martin's eyes darted about, stinging in the wind as he reached terminal velocity.
"I'm okay," Martin thought. "Even if I don't get my staff, the fall won't kill me. It'll hurt like hell, especially if I hit one of those glass and diamond buildings in the city. Those don't look very soft. I could hit the water, but they say that's as bad as landing on concrete."
Martin quickly decided that Plan A was to get his staff and fly gently to the ground, and Plan B was to aim for a grassy area in the park at the center of town. He preferred Plan A. After a moment of panicked searching, he saw his staff tumbling end over end as it fell, a black speck suspended between the blue expanse of the sky and the darker blue expanse of the ocean. He straightened out and pointed his body toward his staff. Progress was slow at first, but he soon started gaining on it. Martin thought,
"Why haven't I ever made a macro that makes my staff fly into my hand on command? That'd be sweet, like Thor's hammer! Oh, I'm about to be attacked. I hold out my hand and yell, 'Santo aquí!' and it sails through the air right into my hand, and whoever's about to attack me then wets themselves. Of course, the shell won't execute the macro unless I have the staff already. That's a problem. Maybe I could sew a wand into my robe somewhere. The shell might recognize that, but then I wouldn't need my staff in the first place. Oh, hey, I need my staff!"
Martin snapped out of it just in time to overshoot his staff. He cursed, then arched his back and spread his arms like he'd seen skydivers do on TV. He swung around and made another attempt to reach his staff, which was now falling straight down like a spear due to the wind resistance caused by the bust at the staff's top. Time slowed. The wind was deafening. The light was unbearably bright. Colors seemed more vivid. The ground was getting unnervingly close. Martin's fingers were inches from the staff and closing.
"This is pretty James Bond right here," he thought.
He pictured himself grasping his staff, saying the flight spell, rather than the obvious joke, and soaring back into the sky just before he hit the ground. He wished there was a way to get a video of it to show the guys later. His hand was getting closer. Closer. He was almost there. It was within his grasp. He stretched and closed his hand. Martin's fall stopped abruptly. His hand closed on thin air as the staff continued its fall. He would have cried out in anger and shock, but the wind had been knocked out of him. He could tell from the glow that surrounded him that he was being held in a force field. He groaned and rolled onto his back. The force field was coming from Gwen, who was far above him. She had her wand in one hand, generating the field that held Martin. The other hand held Ampix by the shoulder as he floated weightless beside her. The force field had stopped him more gently than the ground would have, so it hurt less. But that pain was spread out over a longer deceleration, so Martin figured it was a wash. Anyway, he had plenty of time to recover, since Gwen and Ampix were hundreds of feet above him and took their time coming down to his altitude. Martin looked below. He figured he was about 500 feet above the rim of the city. The city center was substantially further away. From this height, the city looked like a bowl full of sugar cubes with a bad ant infestation. Martin scanned the roofs that lined the inner bowl of the city. Luckily, since the roofs were white and the staff was dark, it stood out. It had come to rest on one of the smaller buildings just below the rim. If the wind had pushed it just a little further, it would have landed in the ocean beyond the city wall. It might have sunk and been lost forever. Martin turned over onto his back again and saw that Gwen and Ampix were almost to him. He yelled up at them,
"That hurt!"
Gwen yelled back,
"Would you rather I let you hit the ground?"
Ampix yelled,
"My ears hurt!"
Martin said,
"I wouldn't have hit the ground. I almost had my staff!"
"No, you didn't," Gwen said.
Ampix asked,
"Is it like they're stuffed with something?"
"Gwen, I nearly had it. It was in my hand."
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't know that, did I? I was all the way up there tending to him.
Ampix yelled.
What's in my ears? I can't hear so well,
Martin said.
Okay. Thanks for trying.
Look,
Gwen shouted.
If your heart was set on falling all the way to the ground, I can still make that happen.
No, you're right. Thanks for catching me. Out of gratitude, I won't point out that I was right all along.
Yeah, thanks for not pointing that out.
But I was,
Martin said.
Right, I mean, all along?
Yes, Martin. You have a gift for understanding stupidity. Can we focus, please?
Ampic stuck a finger in his ear and shook it.
It's like I've been swimming,
Martin said.
My staff is down there.
He pointed to the staff. Gwen looked down at a totally different part of the city and said,
Uh-oh.
Martin said,
No, it's not over there. It's right here, below me.
Gwen said,
Martin, look.
She pointed toward the government buildings at the center of town. Two of the tiny black dots were clearly flying toward the general location of Martin's staff.
Ida and Nilo?
Martin asked.
Yes,
Gwen said.
I saw them leave from her balcony. They probably watched us fall.
Then they're looking for my staff. They know I'm powerless without it. Then they'll only have you to deal with. Gwen, I gotta get to my staff now!
Gwen smiled and withdrew the spell that was holding Martin in the air. Martin shouted,
Thank you!
As he streaked away toward the ground.
It won't hurt me. It won't hurt me. It won't hurt me!
Martin thought as the rooftop and his staff got larger and larger in his vision. His memories of being tossed around the courtyard of the Castle Camelot by Jimmy flooded back, and he corrected himself.
It will hurt me, but it won't kill me! It won't kill me! It won't!
Martin and Philip had wondered about the exact makeup of the buildings in Atlantis. They knew that the outer bowl was made up of molecularly pure diamond, that Brit the Elder had laid down one atom at a time. But the white buildings inside the bowl had seemed more like glass. Later, Martin would find out that all of the structural, non-decorative elements of the city were indeed made of diamond, but that walls, floors, and ceilings had a thin coating of white silicon, because it was quite strong and could be made opaque, or at least mostly opaque, without weakening its structure. Also, it was easy to clean. The incredible strength and rigidity of structures made of diamond meant that when Martin hit the roof of this smallish building, the roof did not buckle or give in any noticeable way. Martin's body, however, did both of those things. For the second time in a 5-minute span, he lay groaning, trying to get his wind back. He was in the center of a radiating pattern of spiderweb cracks in the thin glass veneer. As he lay there, he saw Ida swoop down and deposit Nilo on the roof before rising back into the sky, turning sharply and zooming in the direction from which he had come. Nilo sprinted across the roof, snatched up the staff, kicked Martin in the head, and jumped down to the street. Martin scurried to the edge of the roof, not bothering to get to his feet, and leapt down after Nilo. By the time Martin had his bearings, Nilo was already running away, down the narrow, crowded footpath between the rows of shiny white buildings. Martin gave chase. It did not take long for Martin to realize that he was not gaining on Nilo. Even with the traffic slowing him down, Nilo moved fast enough that Martin was struggling to keep up. Actually catching him did not seem realistic. Martin shouted,
Gwen, a little help here!
He didn't know that she was within hearing range, but he suspected she was, and was relieved when he heard her reply from overhead.
I've got to go after Ida,
Gwen said.
Here's some help, though.
In his peripheral vision, he saw Gwen gently lower Ampix to the ground at running speed. As soon as the guard's feet were on the ground, she was gone, off to deal with the president of Atlantis. Far from being disappointed, Martin was delighted to have Ampix on his side.
He might not be the smartest guy, Martin thought, but I trust him, and he's just as big and strong as Nilo.
His spirits buoyed by not being in this alone, Martin found some extra speed. He might have gained slightly on Nilo. It was hard to tell at this distance. What he could tell instantly was that he was outrunning Ampix. Martin slowed slightly, looked over, and could plainly see that the big guard was already winded.
What's wrong?
Martin asked.
I don't run very often,
Ampix answered.
What?
Martin couldn't believe it.
Look at you! You're a walking wall of muscle and tan! How can you be in such terrible shape?
Ampix said,
I don't know. I'm just lucky, I guess. I don't even exercise.
Clearly,
Martin said. Martin looked toward Nilo, still in the distance, gracefully weaving through the pedestrians with his staff.
I'm not going to catch him on foot,
Martin thought.
And neither is Ampix. Come on, Martin. You've seen plenty of movies. What does the chaser usually do in these situations?
He cursed quietly, then shouted,
Stop! Thief! Somebody stop that man!
Martin thought,
These battles are never quite as epic as you hope they're gonna be.
Ida flew at a fairly relaxed pace, clearly not concerned that anyone might be following her. As such, Gwen did not have to follow her for long and was soon flying next to her.
Gwen,
Ida said,
I'm surprised to see you. I figured you'd want to help Martin get his ugly stick back.
Gwen said,
Nah, I figured I'd let him and Ampix take care of it.
Ida smiled.
Nilo's gonna beat Martin like a drum. You know that, right?
Oh, I don't know. Martin can take...
Gwen's mind quickly flashed back to Martin's famous battle with Jimmy. She reformulated the end of her sentence.
A beating pretty well.
The two stared at each other for a moment and slowly came to a halt, high above the park that marked the center of Atlantis. Gwen broke the silence.
What are you going to do, Ida?
What are you going to do, Gwen?
That depends.
On what?
Gwen said.
On what you do. Because if you do anything other than go to a public place, admit what you've done, and beg for forgiveness, I'll have to try to stop you.
Ida seemed galled by the unfairness of the situation.
I haven't done anything, Gwen.
You gave your servant powers.
Limited powers?
Now Gwen was galled.
Limited to only things that could do people harm. And why? Because he wanted to kill Brit.
No,
Ida said.
I didn't give him powers because he wanted to kill Brit. I gave him powers because I loved him and wanted him to be happy. And he wanted to kill Brit because he loves me and wants to see me happy.
Has killing Brit and Philip made either of you happy?
Ida rolled her eyes.
Gwen, I never would have given him the powers if I thought he had any chance of succeeding. Logic says that he couldn't, and hasn't. He hasn't killed anybody.
Gwen shouted,
We don't know that!
Quietly, Ida replied,
We don't know that he has, do we?
Another icy silence passed. Then Gwen said,
You're not going to apologize, and you're not going to give up, are you?
Ida answered,
I don't see why I should.
They continued to hover in midair, staring each other down. Ida pondered her next logical move. Gwen also pondered Ida's next logical move. Gwen considered her best response. Ida also considered Gwen's best response. They were both as still as statues, trying desperately not to let slip any hint of what they intended to do next. An eternity seemed to pass. Then, almost in unison, they each made identical swiping motions in the air and disappeared. Martin was still keeping pace with Nilo, albeit from many yards behind.
Stop him! Thief!
Martin yelled.
Somebody call the police!
Ampix had given up on keeping up with Martin and was somewhere behind, presumably gasping for air. In the distance, beyond Nilo, Martin could see that the narrow footpath between buildings widened out into some sort of large public space, like a plaza or a market.
Oh no,
Martin thought.
I'm gonna lose him.
Nilo emerged from the tight confines of the footpath into the open space beyond, and as predicted, the crowd filled in behind him, completely blocking him from view. Martin continued to run, but his heart was no longer in it. He was certain that he would reach the opening, spend several seconds frantically searching the square, and not find Nilo or his staff. Martin emerged from the narrow path into a public square with shops and market stalls around the edges, and a fountain in the center. Three sides of the square were lined with buildings. The fourth was open to the great bowl that formed the city of Atlantis. It wasn't so much a public plaza as it was a public balcony. He could tell all of this at a glance because the people who had been filling the stall were crowding out toward the edges, like a flock of birds instinctively avoiding a hawk. In the center of the square, directly in front of the fountain, where he had plenty of room to maneuver, Nilo stood, facing Martin, wielding Martin's own staff menacingly. Martin stopped running. He took a second to catch his breath, then walked casually out into the now empty space in the center of the square, until he stood close enough to count the teeth in the smug smile on Nilo's face. Martin said,
"I've got you now."
Nilo said,
"You have nothing. Look at you. You think you're so smart. You and your girlfriend, and all the sorceresses and those other ridiculous men in their stupid-looking clothes."
Martin said,
"You're wearing a shirt made out of a net."
Nilo ignored him.
"You all think you're so smart. You don't even know what smart is. I've shown you who's smart."
Martin continued,
"I mean, a shirt has three jobs. Cover you up, protect you from the sun, and keep you warm. Your shirt fails on all three counts."
"No, a shirt's main function is to make the wearer look good. I'm sure covering your torso makes you more attractive, but showing mine off works for me."
"Eh, you've got me there," Martin admitted.
"Listen to you,"
Nilo said, still smirking.
"You still think you're smarter than me. Well, I've been one step ahead of you from the beginning."
"Well, of course you were one step ahead. You started first."
"Yes,"
Nilo said.
"That was my first great move."
"What?" Martin asked. "Trying to kill Brit before we decided to try to stop you?"
"Yes. You never saw it coming,"
Martin said.
"Well, I suppose you've got me there, too."
Nilo laughed.
"Huh. For someone who thinks he's so smart, you seem to lose a lot of arguments. You ever wonder why? It's because you think all there is to being smart is being clever and knowing things. There's more to it than that."
"No,"
Martin said.
"I'm pretty sure being clever and knowing things is pretty much all there is to being smart."
"You're missing the most important part. Winning!"
"What?"
Martin shook his head.
"That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard."
"Or you're the dumbest man who's ever heard it."
"Winning makes you smart?" Martin asked.
"Yes,"
Nilo replied.
"Of course it does. It's smarter to win than to lose, so whomever wins must be the smartest. Isn't that just logic?"
Martin said,
"An interesting idea. We'll discuss it again after you've lost."
Nilo said,
"I'm not gonna lose. I've got the staff."
Now it was Martin's turn to laugh.
"Nilo, you know you can't use my staff, right?"
Nilo arched one eyebrow.
"Can't I?"
Nilo swung the staff with all of his strength, hitting Martin in the ribs. Martin cried out in pain and surprise. Physical blows could not injure him, but they did hurt, and all animals, wizards included, instinctively dislike and avoid pain. Martin used his arms to protect his head, neck, and face, so Nilo continued to pound on his ribs and midsection like a crazed toddler who doesn't understand the rules of t-ball. After several savage blows to the breadbasket, Martin lowered his hands and attempted to catch the head of the staff mid-swing. Nilo expected this and altered his swing to catch Martin in the ear. The crowd of Atlanteans who were still gathered around the square groaned in unison as the dull, hollow thunk noise of the blow reverberated off of the buildings like someone had dropped a coconut from a great height. Martin slewed sideways sickeningly, pushed off balance by the force of the blow. Nilo wound up for another swing, but Martin took off running. Nilo pursued him, still striking him with the staff whenever an opportunity presented itself. Unfortunately, by that time, all exits from the square were blocked by gawkers, and Martin had nowhere to go. So he ran in a large circle, completing a full lap of the square with Nilo close on his heels, striking him in the hips, thighs, and buttocks with his own staff. On his third lap of the square, Martin saw Ampix finally make his way to the front of the crowd. He had caught his breath and was eating an apricot he'd clearly bought from one of the fruit stands. As he ran past, Martin cried, "Ampix, help me out!" Martin and Nilo completed another lap. As they came close again, Ampix said,
"I'm not really much of a fighter."
Again, Martin ran out of conversation range, taking several more painful blows as he orbited away from and then back toward Ampix.
"But you're a guard!"
Martin shouted as he ran past again. Ampix waited for Martin to come close again and yelled,
"We never get into any real fights!"
As they ran around to the far side of the square again, Nilo bellowed,
"Maybe you don't!"
and cracked Martin in the right hip. Ampix knew he had to act. He waited for Martin and Nilo to come around again, and when they did, Ampix lost his nerve. He watched them for another orbit, psyched himself up, then, when they came close, he gave chase.
"Hey!"
Ampix yelled.
"Hey! Stop that!"
They ran two more laps that way, Martin fleeing, Nilo striking him, Ampix yelling at him to stop. Ampix realized that yelling wasn't doing the trick, so he threw his half-eaten apricot, hitting Nilo on the back of the head. Nilo stopped, felt the sticky mess dribbling down his neck, and started chasing Ampix. Martin barely had time for a few deep breaths before he had to chase Nilo. The three men were back to running laps of the square, but in the opposite direction. Ampix was setting a faster pace than Martin had.
"Great," Martin thought. "Now you can run."
He knew that Ampix's newfound speed was probably inspired by the fact that Ampix could get injured, and that Nilo would probably be happy to do it. Martin had been running to avoid pain. Ampix was running to avoid death. Ampix had risked his life to help Martin, and Martin felt a duty to make sure that he came out of this in one piece. That said, he was not going to be able to outrun Nilo anytime soon. For some crazy reason, Martin's brain flashed on the film Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan. Specifically, Martin clearly heard Spock saying, "His pattern indicates two-dimensional thinking." Martin cut across the square, sprinted hard, and dove head first, intercepting Nilo and catching his neck in the crook of his elbow. Nilo staggered but remained on his feet. Martin clung to his back, hanging on with his right arm, and repeatedly, but ineffectually, punching him in the side of the head with his left. Nilo retaliated by swinging the staff backward, as if he were an overweight Russian man in a sauna, whacking himself on the back with eucalyptus branches. While Nilo was thus distracted, Ampix attacked by darting in, kicking him in the shins repeatedly, then darting out of staff range to wait for his next opportunity to strike. Vikram, the fakir, pushed his way to the front of the crowd. He didn't know what was going on, but he figured that if that many people were watching it, it was most likely something he wanted to see. His reasoning, it turned out, was sound. He watched the three men floundering in their pathetic stalemate for a moment, then scanned the crowd for familiar faces. The first ones he found were Gilbert and Sid, who were also at the front of the crowd and seemed on the verge of bursting with delight. Vikram shouted to them,
"The wizard from Camelot is in trouble!"
Gilbert shouted back,
"Yes!"
They watched the struggle for a moment. The sounds of grunts, curses, and smacking noises echoed around them.
"Shouldn't we help him?"
Vikram asked. Sid said,
"No!"
Vikram stared at him. Sid looked shamed, then said,
"Oh, of course we're going to help him, just not yet. Let us have just a little more of this, will you?"
Nilo staggered toward the middle of the square. Martin's arm was clamped over the larger man's eyes, and Martin was pulling on his ear, causing him to spin involuntarily to the left. Nilo swung the staff blindly in a wide arc, trying to find Ampix, who was well out of range, throwing small rocks at him from a safe distance. Nilo stopped spinning, despite Martin's continued ear pulling. He also stopped swinging the staff in his futile effort to hit Ampix. He knew that he needed to get his vision back if he was going to end the fight. He stood still for a moment, then leapt into the air and flopped to the ground directly on his back. All of his considerable weight came down on Martin's diaphragm, a move that loosened Martin's grip on Nilo's head. Nilo jerked his head forward, free of Martin's grasp, then spun at the waist, driving his left elbow into Martin's ribs. Nilo quickly located Ampix and hurled the heavy staff as hard as he could. It pinwheeled through the air until the heavy plaster bust of Santo connected with the side of Ampix's knee. The guard's leg bent at an unnatural angle. He cried out in pain, dropping his handful of throwing pebbles to clutch at his injured knee. Nilo rose, grabbed Martin by the throat, lifted him to his feet, then slammed him back to the ground. Nilo repeated this process several times, laughing as he did so. Vikram gave Sid a look that said, "I'm going to do something even if you're not." Sid rolled his eyes, but bellowed,
"All right, Bob, that's quite enough!"
Nilo had Martin back on his feet, but stopped short of slamming him to the ground again when he heard the magician. Martin took advantage of this lull in the action to savagely swipe at Nilo's face, but since Nilo had him by the throat, and Martin's arms were substantially shorter than Nilo's, he connected with nothing but empty air. Nilo turned to face the voice that had dared interrupt his fun. He saw Sid and Gilbert, resplendent in their Victorian formal attire, wielding their white-tipped canes at him, and Vikram in his orange robe, holding what appeared to be a flute. Nilo faced the three of them, smiling.
"Do what you will," he shouted.
He shook Martin by the throat and said,
"But choose your next move carefully. I doubt you want to hurt your friend."
A blindingly fast bolt of sparkling green energy sizzled from the end of Gilbert's cane and struck Martin directly in the chest, violently tearing him free of Nilo's grip and sending him skidding to a stop several yards back. Nilo stared at his stinging hand in disbelief, then looked at his three attackers in anger. He swiped at the air with the index fingers of both hands. Arrows materialized in midair. Nilo looked surprised when they fell straight to the ground, but immediately realized that since he'd eliminated Brit, the arrows had nobody to be attracted to. He quickly adjusted, summoning two more arrows, catching them in midair, and throwing them overhand at Sid. He quickly found a rhythm, and was soon producing and flinging arrows at an impressive rate of speed. Vikram had just as quickly played a few notes on his flute, which had thrown up a force field. Once it was in place, he didn't need to keep playing, so he and the magicians were free to talk while the arrows bounced impotently off of the shield. Gilbert said,
"Good work with that. What is that, part of an old bagpipe?"
"It's called a punji,"
Vikram answered.
"It's played with circular breathing, like a didgeridoo."
Sid said,
"Thank you, Wikipedia. Anyway, when do you think he'll stop throwing arrows at us?"
Vikram said,
"Dunno, when he gets tired, I guess. He certainly doesn't seem to be letting their lack of effectiveness stop him."
"Yeah, about that," Sid said. "Those arrows look familiar. I think this little display answers the question of who was trying to kill young Brit."
Gilbert watched several more arrows bounce lamely off of the force field and add to the pile that was forming on the ground.
"Indeed. I think it also explains why you've never heard anyone described as the world's deadliest arrow thrower."
The two guards who were assigned to watch Brit the Elder's patio were at ease. They didn't know that Brit's powers, like all of the sorceress's powers, were derived from a computer program called the Atlantis Interface. Or that the computer running the Atlantis Interface was located in Brit's home, because she wrote it. Or that the rules built into the Atlantis interface made it impossible for a sorceress to teleport directly into another sorceress's home, even if that sorceress was missing, like Brit the Elder was. They might have been dimly aware that the best way to gain entry to Brit the Elder's home would be from the very patio they were guarding, but they weren't worried about it. Precisely because they did not know that Ida and Gwen were coming their way, both intent on denying the other the use of their powers. The two sorceresses appeared at the same time, materializing out of thin air and falling about 3 feet to the ground. Ida hit the ground running, but facing the wrong direction, so she had to make a sharp turn to aim herself at the door into Brit the Elder's home. This gave Gwen time to react, and she did by creating a force field that blocked Ida's path. Ida bounced off of the invisible field, a chaotic cloud of flying hair and flailing arms. She fell to the ground, looked up, and saw Gwen sprinting for the door herself. Gwen only made it a few steps before she struck the force field Ida threw in her way. Ida rose to her feet. She and Gwen stared each other down a bit. Then Ida lunged hard to her right in an effort to catch Gwen by surprise. Gwen had expected this and quickly threw another field, which Ida struck before she had gained any real momentum. Gwen capitalized on Ida's surprise by sprinting to the side to get around Ida's force field, but she wasn't fast enough and ran face first into Ida's second field. Again, the two women stared, each trying to guess what the other was thinking without letting any signs slip of their own thoughts. Gwen got an idea, carefully thought through the motions required to make it work, then took a deep, calming breath. In one swift action, she sprung backward, while at the same moment placing a force field behind Ida in case she followed suit. Ida did not follow suit. Rather, she did the exact same thing at the exact same time. Both women bounced off of the fields behind them and fell to the ground, cursing. Gwen took some comfort from the fact that they chose different curse words. Both women knew that they each only had two unrestricted directions left in which to escape, up and to one side. They were now engaged in a high-stakes guessing game. Which direction would the opposition move next, and which would they block? Ida quickly tilted her shoulders to the left, an obvious feint. Gwen placed a force field directly above her, just in time to watch Ida fly directly into it. Gwen quickly cast one last force field, blocking Ida in completely. Then she darted to her own right and made it several steps before Ida managed to get a field in place to stop her. Gwen picked herself up off of the ground, sneered at Ida, and raised her hand above her head. It hit a force field. Gwen was boxed in as well.
"Well," Ida said, "here we are."
"Yep,"
Gwen agreed, spreading her arms out.
"At least the box I'm stuck in is bigger."
It wasn't much of a victory, but Gwen was happy to take it. Ida, it turned out, was also willing to take it away from her.
"Oh, it is it? Let me fix that."
Ida moved her left hand inward, causing the force field next to Gwen to move inward, pushing her along with it, her feet sliding on the patio floor until she was standing where she had started.
"Oh,"
Ida said,
"that's interesting."
Ida constricted her hands as if she were squeezing a large sponge. Gwen felt the walls and ceiling of her invisible prison start to constrict, forcing her to hunch over and curve her shoulders inward. She quickly followed suit, forcing Ida to bend at the knees in sort of an extended curtsy. The two of them stayed like that for several seconds, hunching and grunting, and straining to remain upright while exerting as much pressure as possible on the other. The two guards looked at each other, unsure how to proceed. One of them cleared his throat and asked in a timid voice,
"I'm sorry, may we be of some assistance?"
Neither Ida nor Gwen said anything, but they both gave him a look that answered his question more eloquently than words ever could. He reacted the way any intelligent man does when he receives that look. He stopped talking, looked straight ahead, and concentrated his energy on wishing he was somewhere else. The guard did not know it, but he did help. He distracted Gwen and Ida just long enough for them to see the futility of what they were doing. When they turned their attention from glaring at the guard to glaring at each other, they did so with anger, but not blind fury. Wordlessly, they eased the pressure on each other. Soon they were both standing upright. Gwen chuckled at her own stupidity and teleported 5 feet forward. She was free of the invisible cage in which she had been trapped. Ida followed suit. The two women stood facing each other for a moment. Then Ida cautiously turned toward the door into Brit the Elder's abode. Gwen started to cast another force field, but stopped just shy of committing, instead saying,
"Ida, you don't really want to start that again, do you?"
"I suppose not." "Okay, Gwen, what's your next move?"
Gwen said,
"You won't like it. I know I don't. I really hoped it wouldn't come to this."
Ida's face fell as she realized what Gwen intended to do, but by then it was too late. Gwen's hand had selected the menu item that opened a direct voice link with every sorceress in Atlantis. It was meant for emergencies, and Gwen had decided this was one. Gwen shouted,
"Come quick to Brit's patio! Ida and her servant are the ones who've been trying to kill Brit, and she just tried to cut me out of the interface. Without the Brits here, she figures she's in charge. I need help to stop her!"
It wasn't a bad speech for someone who was under stress. It was concise, informative, and fraught with genuine emotional content. Unfortunately, once Ida realized what Gwen was doing, she put out a distress call of her own, basically blurting out,
"No, that's not true! I can explain! Don't listen to her! She was going to cut me out, too!"
Gwen's entire message after Brit's patio was unintelligible because of the crosstalk. None of her accusations got out, and she knew it. She gave Ida a look that would have utterly destroyed a person who was capable of feeling shame. Ida smiled and shrugged. Gwen took a second to ponder her next move, then realized she didn't have to, because sorceresses started materializing en masse. The bulk of her message had been garbled, but the most important part, Gwen and Ida are fighting at Brit's patio, got through loud and clear, and it was obviously enough to draw a crowd. After many dozens of arrows had been thrown, even Nilo realized that they were not going to hurt anybody as long as the wizards had a shield up. The act of throwing them had distracted him long enough for Ampix to hobble out of harm's way into the crowd, which was getting larger by the second. Ampix was greeted by the two wizards from China, who used magic to dull his pain and listened as Ampix told them the story up to this point. Martin had gotten his wits back, and that's why he kept quiet. He was in a crouch behind Nilo, whose attention was focused on the shield Vikram had raised. Martin knew that if he engaged Nilo without his staff, the result would just be another ignominious beating until Gilbert or Sid chose to shoot him out of Nilo's hands again. He could see his staff lying on the ground only 10 yards away, but it was in front of Nilo. If Nilo saw him dive for it, he'd likely grab Martin before he could get to it. Martin waited. Soon Nilo would get distracted, and that was when he would strike. Nilo was not one to keep doing something futile when he had another equally futile idea to try. True to form, he stopped throwing arrows and started producing and throwing what appeared to be small lumps of clear putty. Vikram, Gilbert, and Sid, standing safely on the other side of Vikram's shield, looked at each other, confused as several lumps of the stuff clung to the shield, apparently hanging in midair. Nilo traced another crude shape in the air, and they all exploded with a sound like a 21-gun salute, delivered with bottles of champagne instead of rifles. Of course, the explosions, though powerful, did not penetrate the shield. Their main effect was that they caused Sid to say,
"And that explains how he brought the statues down."
"Yes," Gilbert agreed. "Of course, it's an open question as to how he got his powers and what all powers he may have."
"I don't know," Vikram said. "I suspect the arrows and the explosions may be his whole bag of tricks."
"Either his repertoire is limited or
his imagination is," Gilbert said.
"By the way, I dare say the advantage is ours."
Sid saw that other delegates had started arriving. He didn't know if they'd been drawn by the noise or the excitement, or if word had simply gotten out that there was a magic battle underway. He recognized John and his cohort from the Chinese delegation, the Romani gypsies, the Egyptians, and at least one Incan. He also saw Richard, the wizard who wore only a loincloth and a hat made of a wolf's skull. Sid said,
"We have plenty of backup if things go pear-shaped. Let's give him a scare and see how he reacts."
Gilbert smiled.
"Splendid idea. On three?"
The two men counted to three, then doffed their top hats in unison, swirling their canes with a decorative flourish. They were enveloped in a shimmering blue light. When that light dissipated, they were both transformed. Gilbert's head was smooth and bulbous. His eyes glowed red. His lower face was obscured by a tangled mass of twitching, coiling tentacles. A pair of leathery bat wings sprouted from his back and flapped, making a noise like someone opening an umbrella made of suede. Sid's hair had grown long and matted into jet-black curls. His forehead had swelled and distorted with countless ridges. His eyes were glistening, evil jewels that peered out from deep, cruel eye sockets. His nose was a pair of nasty holes in the middle of his now equally nasty face, and his mouth was a slathering mass of viscous saliva and fangs. Both men had grown by several feet and had become much more physically massive, but their suits had expanded with them. Sid nodded to his counterpart and placed his now much larger top hat atop his mass of oily black curls. He tilted his head toward Nilo, who had been momentarily stunned into inaction, and said,
"Shall we?"
His mouth emitted as much saliva as it did sound. Gilbert put on his hat, got a firm grip on his walking stick, and with a hand that now featured five squirming tentacles where fingers had once been, gestured toward Nilo. In a tentacle-muffled voice, he said,
"After you."
The monstrous magicians advanced on Nilo, their walking sticks held before them menacingly. Nilo screamed as if all of his nightmares were coming true, but he stood his ground and defended himself the best way he knew how, by throwing arrows with one hand and exploding goo bombs with the other. Wearily, the magicians raised their own protective force fields. Sid snarled,
"We'd better think of something quick, if he ever thinks to start sticking the exploding goo to the hand-thrown arrows, we're all done for."
Gilbert wouldn't have thought it was possible to sound sarcastic and dismissive while snorting and drooling, but Sid managed it. Martin saw that Nilo was in a blind panic. Clearly none of the sorceresses had ever brought a copy of Fangoria back for their coffee table. Martin knew this was his chance. He made his way to the outer edge of Nilo's peripheral vision and prepared to make a dive for his staff. He planned what spell to use as soon as his fingers made contact. All he needed was the right moment. Gilbert parted his face tentacles to be heard clearly.
"This is no good," he said. "Scaring him is not enough. We need to subdue him."
Sid slobbered,
"We'll just pin him to the ground with a force field."
Gilbert shook his head, causing his tentacles to swing like the tassels on a ballroom dancer's dress.
"Let me rephrase. We need to subdue him in the most entertaining manner possible. We don't get to use our powers this way often. It would be a shame not to capitalize."
Sid said,
"Fun is fun, but the longer we draw this out, the better the chances are of one of these spectators getting hurt."
Vikram shouted,
"I have just the thing! Gentlemen, shield the crowd! Just leave a hole in front of me!"
Every delegate in the crowd did as they were asked, instantly surrounding the open space in a protective field, sealing in Nilo and Martin as well. As Vikram again raised his punji to his mouth, Martin made his move, diving for his staff. Sadly, it was too late. He saw some sort of dark mass shoot at high speed from the end of the punji, and was driven to the ground under the weight of what people outside the force field could see was an undulating mountain made up of millions of live cobras. The crowd that had gathered to watch the battle dispersed instantly, screaming and fleeing from the horrific scene. They ran far enough away to not be afraid of the cobras, but not so far away that they couldn't see what would happen next. The delegates from different cultures and times worked together to keep the snakes contained, and Nilo and Martin contained, buried beneath the squirming serpents, like children hiding in the ball pit at a Chuck E. Cheese. Vikram looked proud. Gilbert and Sid looked delighted, or as delighted as they could in their current condition. One of the Egyptians turned to the other and said,
"Asps, very dangerous. You go first."
Which got a nice laugh out of all of the delegates. Brit the Elder's patio was large, more than large enough to host every sorceress in Atlantis, and that was a good thing, because they had all teleported in, drawn by the promise of some genuine drama. At first there was quite a bit of chaos. They were all accustomed to deferring to Brit the Elder, but she wasn't there, leaving a power vacuum. The next obvious authority figure was Britt the Younger, who was also gone. That left Ida, but to Gwen's relief, everybody seemed to recognize that neither Ida nor Gwen should be running the show, since they both clearly had an agenda. After a brief conversation, Louisa, the doctor, took charge of the situation, and nobody argued, which in this case was all the vote they needed to take. Of course, Gwen already had the crowd on her side. She wasn't sure this would be the case. After all, Ida was popular enough with the other sorceresses to get herself elected to the only elected office they had. Happily, as the other sorceresses started to arrive, they all noticed that Gwen seemed genuinely happy to have other people involved in the argument, while Ida seemed frantic and skittish and tried to hide it under an increasingly unconvincing front. Once all of the sorceresses had arrived, Louisa told the guards to leave, which they did, gratefully. Then the sorceresses set about trying to figure out what was going on. They formed a rough circle with Gwen and Ida in the center and told them both to explain themselves. This might sound like a less aggressive approach than the male delegates were pursuing further out toward the rim of the city, but from Ida and Gwen's point of view, it didn't feel less aggressive.
All right, you two,
Louisa said.
You called us all here. What's going on?
Ida said,
I didn't call you here. She called you all here, not me. I told you not to listen to her.
Louisa held up her hands to make Ida both quieter and calmer.
Okay.
Louisa said.
Fine, Ida. You didn't call us here. This meeting is Gwen's doing.
Ida smiled, feeling as if she'd scored a point. Louisa said,
Okay, Gwen. You call everyone here. What's going on?
Wait, what?
Ida shouted.
Why does she get to explain things? How's that fair?
Louisa squinted at Ida, then, in a slow, even tone, said,
She's the one who called us here. I think we'd all like to know why. It seems logical to ask her for an explanation. Actually, Ida,
Gwen said,
I think it would be better for everyone if you did explain what's going on.
She softened her expression as much as she could and looked Ida directly in the eye.
Go ahead, Ida. Tell them what's happened from your point of view. They'll listen.
She hoped her message was piercing through all the layers of ego and embarrassment and panic, actually reaching Ida's brain. Gwen thought this might be Ida's only chance at redeeming herself. Ida muttered,
I don't know.
Then she broke her eye contact with Gwen, shrugged, and in a loud, clear voice said,
I don't know why Gwen called you all here. I can't think of anything she'd have to say, unless she intends to lie.
Gwen grimaced. Ida misinterpreted this as a sign that she'd scored another point. Louisa squinted again, then said,
Well, I can see why you fought to get the chance to say that you don't know what she's going to say.
Except that I know it'll be a lie,
Ida corrected her. Gwen realized that on a certain level, she missed Jimmy. At least he'd been a good liar. Ida was panicking, and there's a reason you never hear anyone say, Luckily I panicked and did something really smart.
Noted,
Louisa said in an effort to placate Ida. She turned to Gwen.
Okay, your turn.
Gwen said,
Ida's in a romantic relationship with her servant, Nilo.
Most of the sorceresses laughed at this. Louisa smiled and shook her head. She started to say something, but Gwen cut her off.
Because of her feelings for Nilo, she used the file to stop his aging.
Louisa's expression changed. She no longer looked amused. She looked concerned. The other sorceresses stopped laughing as well, but Gwen noted that instead of looking concerned, many of them looked embarrassed.
And
Gwen continued, fearing she may lose what little momentum she had.
When she told him about it, he talked her into giving him other powers.
Gwen saw a lot less quiet embarrassment among the sorceresses, and a lot more quiet shock. Louisa looked at Ida and asked,
What powers?
Ida said nothing, so Gwen answered,
The power to make small explosives, powerful enough to bring down a statue. The power to create enchanted arrows that home in on a specific target. The power to create portals in space. He told her he wanted these powers to eliminate Britt the Younger. He believed that if he did, Britt the Elder would be out of the way as well, leaving Ida as president in charge.
Now Gwen could detect no embarrassment in the crowd, just anger. All eyes turned to Ida, who also looked angry. Louisa said,
"What do you say to that, Ida?"
Ida said,
"See? Lies!"
Several of the women listening groaned.
"Yeah," Ida said. "I know. Why would she make up a lie like that?"
Ida nodded vigorously and wagged her index finger.
"You know what I think?"
She continued nodding.